searching podcasts for The Daily Perspective. Okay, The Daily Perspective podcast coming up.
God bless America.
And good morning, and welcome into this Friday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Congleton here with you for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity for Friday, the 28th day of August in the year 2020. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for being there. Thanks for subscribing to the podcast. I appreciate it very much. Before I go anywhere else, first, a happy birthday. You know, I just don't do these very often. But today, the 28th of August, is my brother Bruce's birthday, so happy birthday, old man. Actually, on Facebook, I said young man. Hey, he's about a year and a half younger than I am, so he's past the big 6-0. I can call him old man if I want to. So happy birthday, bud. Have a good one today. I'm pretty sure that we'll see lots and lots of photos on social media from today. Since he retired, he's been doing a lot of rambling around the state of Alaska where he lives. He lives in the Fairbanks area, and he's been putting a lot of pictures up, going fishing, halibut fishing, and the like. Not jealous at all, not a bit. Well, the Republican National Convention for 2020 has ended. President Trump had his acceptance speech last night, which went something like an hour and 10 minutes, somewhere around there. I have the link to the entire thing in today's show notes, so make sure you get today's show notes. The link to President Trump's speech, a link to the complete night, the video of the entire thing. It's like 3.5 hours long. I've got a link to that in the show notes as well. No, we're not going to play that here. We're not going to play President Trump's speech. It's way too long, and pulling out the bits and pieces will be too hard. I've got a little something here we're going to go over as far as the speech is concerned. What else do we have? We're going to drop a few excerpts from the night in, as we have for the past few days. And we're also going to talk about a couple of other things, time permitting. But from Michael Goodwin over at the New York Post, let's get the ball rolling, shall we? And on day four, there was no more Mr. Nice Guy. Republicans spent the better part of three nights in their convention presenting softer and gentler sides of President Trump. But the president gets the final words, and he came out last night in a fighting mood. His acceptance speech detailed his successes and offered promises plenty for a second term, but the emphasis and energy were committed to a scorched-earth attack on Joe Biden and the Democrats. Trump threw so many punches at his opponent that, had it been a real heavyweight boxing match, the referee would have stopped it in the middle of rounds. In the middle rounds, that is, out of mercy. For example, this election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny. And then a bit later, how can the Democrat Party ask to lead our country when it spends so much time tearing down our country? After saying Biden had buckled to the demands of the socialists in his party, Trump asked, if he can't stand up to them, how's he going to stand up for you? Many of the lines echoed Ronald Reagan, and the two men share key traits, perhaps the most important being a willingness to take on Washington from the inside without ever losing their outsider's perspective. If there was any doubt, last night settled the question of whether 4 years in the White House have warmed Trump's heart to the Beltway. No, no, 1,000 times no. Instead, he detailed numerous examples of where he believed he was fighting the entire establishment to get things done for the American people, including standing up against China's theft of jobs and intellectual property and stopping illegal immigration. In his mind, he's often a lonely warrior. While Reagan's folksy charm belied a core of steely conviction, Trump generally prefers to dispense with the niceties and get down to business. And make no mistake, last night's speech was all business. He came not to debate Joe Biden, but to bury him. On the merits, it was an effective argument on every front, from the economy to foreign policy to law and order. The routine was for Trump to cite his own first-term accomplishments as more than Biden had done in his 47 years in Washington. The only question was whether the pounding was too brutal for those swing voters in the swing states the president is courting. Some are disaffected Trump supporters, and some are undecideds, often because polls show they don't approve of the president's bull in a china shop conduct. The issue is so important that Ivanka Trump, in introducing her father, casually noted that his communications are not to everyone's taste and added that his tweets can feel unfiltered. Of course, the acknowledgement was aimed at giving people permission to support the president, despite their misgivings. Moreover, the campaign long ago learned that Trump will be Trump and made its bet that the public will put results over any qualms about style, taste, and personality. And while the speech on the White House lawn had a rally feel about it, the attacks on Biden were substantive and policy-based. While Democrats want the election to be about the president's handling of the virus, another key issue has emerged that could prove more decisive. The riots, looting, and crime surges in the nation's cities have become a political flashpoint. One reason is that nearly all the cities are run by Democratic mayors. Another is that Biden and the party didn't say a single word about the destruction at their convention, instead embracing Black Lives Matter and treating the protesters as New Age heroes. Trump and the GOP have been jumping on the error ever since, and it became a major focus of the convention. The president cited it numerous times last night as another disqualifying action or inaction by the opponent, his opponent. Already, polls have started to reflect public unease with the chaos. And while Democrats had hoped they could use it as a reason to turn the tide against the president, they seem to realize they made a serious miscalculation. Biden has spoken out twice in recent days about the violence, a clear sign that he sees the danger. Still, his words have been more pleading than the president's, who is eager to send in federal troops if local governments and police can't gain control of the streets. The spreading violence is scaring Americans everywhere, with the situation in Kenosha, Wisconsin, perhaps more frightening than what's been happening in Portland, Seattle, and elsewhere. Kenosha is a city of only 100,000 people, and the violence there is all the more shocking than what is happening in much larger cities. In effect, Kenosha is something of an everytown, and the riots, arson, and murder could cause more people to identify with it and wonder if their town is next. The issue is undercutting a key feature of the Democrat plan. They used their convention to portray Biden as empathetic, someone who feels the pains of others because he has suffered enormous personal tragedies. But Trump is trying to recast that quality as a weakness, saying that Biden is not tough enough to combat the current wave of lawlessness. In effect, the Trump team is asking, who would you rather have on your side in a street fight? A tough puncher like Trump, or a guy like a Biden who feels the opponent's pain? Before the conventions, Biden had a significant lead in the poll, in most polls. It's likely the race has tightened, but this is a heavyweight match and many more rounds to go. We'll see what today's polling looks like. We'll see if things do shift. Who knows? They could. Let's get back to the violence again, the violence aspect. One of the speakers before the president spoke last night is directly related to that violence. The widow of a victim of the violence in her city, Ann Dorn. Here's what she had to say.
Hello, my name is Ann Dorn. I'd like to introduce you to my husband, David, father of 5, brother of 12, grandfather of 10, friend to thousands. He was the most kind, dedicated, loving life partner I could have hoped for. He had a big smile and a heart to match. He was blessed with the gift of gab, and that gift enabled him to touch souls and inspire people, especially young people. Oh, how kids loved him, and they really loved him back. Dave was all about service. He served 38 years in the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department and 6 years as chief of police as the Moline Acres Police Department. After 44 years, he retired from law enforcement, but he never retired from helping a friend in need. Since he befriended every person he met, he was a very busy man. One example of that was his friendship with a young man named Lee. David met him when Lee was just a kid, after members of his family were attacked and murdered. Dave took a special interest in the boy. They bonded and their friendship grew and remained strong throughout the years. Lee eventually opened a pawn shop. He trusted Dave implicitly and asked Dave to help with security. David readily agreed. Whenever the shop's alarm would go off, the alarm company called Dave. He would investigate. If he got a call after I went to bed, he would wake me up and tell me he was going to Lee's, just to make sure everything was all right. Most of the time, they were false alarms, triggered by a storm or animals. But I never rested easily until I heard Dave's key turn in the door, knowing he was home safe. The alarm that went off the morning of June 2nd was for real. It was a violent night in St. Louis. 4 officers were shot. Others were hit with rocks and fireworks. At least 5 businesses were damaged, looted, or set on fire. As the officer wellness coordinator and CIT coordinator with the police department, I was keenly aware of their rioting and spent the evening getting ready to mobilize support for officers who were impacted. After I'd gone to bed, David received a call from Lee's alarm company. The front door of the pawn shop had been breached. This time he didn't wake me up to tell me. He probably knew I would have tried to stop him or insist on going with him. As I slept, looters were ransacking the shop. They shot and killed David in cold blood and then live-streamed his execution and his last moments on earth. David's grandson was watching the video on Facebook in real time, not realizing he was watching his own grandfather dying on the sidewalk. I learned of all this around 4 a.m. when our doorbell rang. The chief of police was standing outside. I wondered why Dave had not answered the door. It wasn't uncommon for him to be up watching TV at this time. I called out to him several times. There was no reply. He just wasn't there. I let in the chief, and fighting back tears, he uttered the words every officer's spouse dreads. I relive that horror in my mind every single day. My hope is that having you relive it with me now will help shake this country from this nightmare we are witnessing in our cities and bring about positive, peaceful change. How do we get to this point where so many young people are callous and indifferent towards human life? This isn't a video game where you can commit mayhem and then just hit reset and bring all the characters back to life. David is never, never coming back to me. He was murdered by people who didn't know and just didn't care. He would have done anything to help them. Violence and destruction are not legitimate forms of protest. They do not safeguard black lives. They only destroy them. President Trump understands this, has offered federal help to restore order in our communities. In a time when police departments are short on resources and manpower, we need that help. We should accept that help. We must heal before we can affect change, but we cannot heal amid devastation and chaos. President Trump knows we need more Davids in our communities, not fewer. We need to come together in peace and remember that every life is precious.
Ann Dorn, last night from the RNC convention. I I know that is something it's hard to listen to. Her emotion is real. Her pain is real. On the left, they're condemning her. They're saying her husband was not a Trump supporter and would not want his legacy screwed around with this way. And yet, last night, violent Black Lives Matter thugs were in the streets around the White House. And as people left after the festivities, they were attacked. Rand Paul was among them. There were others. The violence in the streets today is being tolerated and accepted by the left. It shouldn't be accepted by anyone. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for Friday, the 28th day of August in 2020. Recapping some things from last night's convention, the final night. I know I didn't give you any personal news. I don't have any personal news, really. It's been raining like crazy. Did a few things around the house yesterday before the rain rolled in, and then the outer bands of Laura sweeping across north central Alabama hit us, and it's been pretty much raining ever since. And it looks like today will be spent indoors with the dog. what do you do? Well, Nancy Pelosi has spoken out. She says she doesn't think there should be any debates between Trump and Biden. Can I see a show of hands? How many saw this coming? Come on. Yeah, it's pretty much everybody. And then you again, you in the back. What is with, could somebody get that guy's address, name and address? We need to send you a package, a care package. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi suggested yesterday President Donald Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden should have conversations with the American people rather than with each other. During her press briefing, Pelosi told reporters Trump isn't capable of debating in a dignified manner. Quote, don't tell anybody I told you this, especially don't tell Joe Biden. I don't think that there should be any debates. I do not think that the President of the United States has comported himself in a way that anybody has any association with truth, evidence, data, and facts. I wouldn't legitimize a conversation with him, nor a debate, in terms of the presidency of the United States. In other words, Donald Trump is too uncouth and shouldn't be in there. Anybody remember the movie King Ralph? Do you get the impression that the Nancy Pelosi sees Donald Trump as King Ralph? He's just not worthy of the presidency. Yeah, that's exactly how she sees him. And she also sees you that way. Don't forget that. Remember, Pelosi called Trump's debates with former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton back in 2016 disgraceful. She accused him of stalking Clinton. Pelosi predicted Trump will act in a way that is beneath the dignity of the presidency. She said, I think he will also belittle what the debates are supposed to be about. And they're not to be about skullduggery on the part of somebody who has no respect for the office he holds, much less the democratic process. Why else would he try to undermine the elections in the manner in which he's doing? Wow. She recommended that each candidate take to their stage and answer questions. This way they can be held accountable and explain their vision for the nation along with how they are going to carry out their promises. By the way, that would also enable Joe Biden to present himself in a way that he could not, were he actually under real pressure. And that's the point of the debates. It's allowing each side to present their case and then rebut the other side. That's the purpose of the debate. And taking that pressure off of Joe Biden gives him the ability to look like he's more capable than he actually is. And considering the friendliness of the press towards the Democrat Party, and we've witnessed it again and again and again in debate moderation, you can be assured that they will treat him with kid gloves. Now, her comments come just one day after Trump told the Washington Examiner he's going to call for drug tests ahead of his debate with Biden next month. They're scheduled to debate on September 29th, October 15th, and October 22nd. Now, you may have seen Trump's demand for drug testing as uncalled for. I actually think it's kind of brilliant. Because we've all seen the video of Joe Biden incapable of composing answers, referring to his notes, reading from scripts. And then we've seen him speak publicly and seem to be in great shape. And he's merely pointing out the difference. Something has to be happening. What is that something? Nancy Pelosi? We've also seen her at these speaking engagements when apparently she's been into the martinis a bit early in the day. Well, one of the speakers last night was Representative Jeff Van Drew, who turned his back on the Democrat Party.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Van Drew. I speak to you as a member of the Republican Party, but it always wasn't that way. How I became a Republican says a lot about today's Democratic Party. I'm from South Jersey, where we work hard, look after our neighbors, and care about our communities. Years ago, I was a local dentist and was asked by the Democrats to run for a town council seat. I had my doubts, and I explained that my views were middle of the road to conservative, but the local leaders said the Democratic Party was a big tent and that they accepted people like me. I was elected to council as a Democrat. But as I won seats for county office, state legislature, and then Congress, I noticed things were changing. The Democratic Party had become less accepting of American tradition, less believing in American exceptionalism, less supportive of traditional faith and family. This was not the party that I knew. In 2018, after being elected to Congress as a Democrat, I was already uncomfortable with a San Francisco liberal running the House, which is why my first vote in Congress was cast against Nancy Pelosi for Speaker. But imagine how I felt after seeing members of the squad quickly take control of the Democratic Party just weeks after being elected. The party had moved from liberal to radical. This new Democratic Party wasn't just for higher taxes. Now they were for open borders, against our police, and against our God-given rights. When the radical Democrats went after President Trump with impeachment, they made another mistake. Democratic leaders told me that I had to vote for impeachment or my life would be made difficult, and I wouldn't be allowed to run again. Listen, I'm from South Jersey, and you better come at me with more than just loud words and empty threats. I voted no on impeachment, and it was an easy call. Soon after, I met with President Trump, and he made me feel more comfortable and welcome in the Oval Office than Nancy Pelosi ever made me feel in her caucus. And a few days later, I officially changed parties, and I became a Republican. Let me tell you about Joe Biden. When the Democrats tried to order me around, I was ready, willing, and able to say, I've had enough with their radical socialist agenda. Do you really believe Joe Biden is ready, willing, and most of all, able to do the same? As Joe says, come on, man. Joe Biden is being told what to do by the radicals running my former party, the same radicals trying to install him as their puppet president. When I'm at my local diner, I tell people that America is the best nation in the world and that President Trump has helped make it that way. Republicans, independents, and even Democrats, they all know that in President Trump's America, we have a strong military, strong support for our police, strong support for our veterans, and strong support for our seniors. In President Trump's America, we have a strong supply chain, good schools, we're energy independent, and we protect our environment. There are a lot of Democrats who support our president and are disgusted for what their old party, what my old party, has become. Here's my advice. Be true to who you are now, not who the Democrats used to be. That's why I'm a proud Republican and why I will be voting for Donald Trump. Thank you, and may God bless you, God bless our president, and God bless the United States of America.
Representative Jeff Van Drew, last night at the Republican National Convention. He had good things to say, important things to say, as do the rest of those we'll be listening to again today. I encourage you to grab the link in today's show notes and watch these. The links to each of these are in the show notes, as well as the links to the president's acceptance speech and the entirety of the event last night. All of it. I have a link in the video to all of it. If you decided, no, I'm not watching this mess, well, there's a link in today's show notes. Hello, today's show notes. To the entire 3.5 hours, which you can skip through, fast forward through, back up and watch things again to be sure you heard what you thought you heard, and you can be informed. And when the mainstream press tries to deceive you, you can go back to it again and say, no, that's actually not what was said. Take advantage of the resource. More after the break. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for Friday, the 28th day of August, 2020. Hope you've got a good weekend ahead. Hope you're going to get some time away, unplugged, be in the quiet for a little while, and face things. Be honest with your life. It's important. Well, the Justice Department on Wednesday sent out letters to the governors of New York and three other Democratic-led states seeking data on whether they violated federal law by ordering public nursing homes to accept recovering COVID-19 patients from hospitals. Actions that have been criticized for potentially fueling the spread of the virus. Prosecutors said the fact-finding letters, also sent to New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, were aimed at determining whether the orders may have resulted in the deaths of thousands of elderly nursing home residents. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights Division Eric Dryband said, "We must ensure they are adequately cared for with dignity and respect and not unnecessarily put at risk." Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf said his office was reviewing the request. Spokespeople for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said the fact that all the states are led by Democrats and the timing of the move in the midst of the Republican National Convention spoke volumes about the political nature of the inquiry. Wow. Whitmer spokesperson Tiffany Brown said Americans would all be better served if the Trump administration stopped the partisan games and focused on delivering a real plan to defeat COVID-19. I think that's very interesting because Governor Whitmer's spokesperson, Tiffany Brown, clearly does not understand the nature of America's government. that it is their responsibility to care for the people of their state. It is not the federal government's responsibility to care for the needs of their state. And passing the buck is all you're doing by pointing fingers back at the Trump administration, which the Democrats are trying to do. And saying that it's a political move, well, politics is involved because these Democrat-led states are where the worst examples have happened, where the most people have been hurt, where there have been the most cases and the most deaths. In fact, recent studies show that most of the infections in the country originated in New York. They can trace it back. So no, it's not political. But of course, the leftists want to make it political. The governor's actions at the height of the pandemic were designed to ensure hospitals had enough bed space for the most serious COVID cases, but were almost immediately criticized by nursing homes and relatives for potentially putting frail, elderly care home residents at risk. Cuomo's March 25th order, for example, specifically told homes they could not refuse to accept recovering COVID-19 patients from hospitals as long as the patients were medically stable. The order barred homes from even testing such patients to see if they still had the virus. Some homes said they feared they would lose their licenses if they didn't comply. Cuomo, who said he was following guidelines from Federal Centers for Disease, the FDC, the CDC, and reversed the order under pressure May 10th, long after New York's death toll in care homes had climbed to among the nation's highest. Long-term care facilities represent less than 1% of the U.S. population, but they account for 42% of COVID-19 deaths, with more than 70,000 fatalities reported by the COVID Tracking Project. Hopefully, this will reveal the truth about what was happening. The truth about the inefficiency, the ineffectiveness, the corruption of Democrat leadership in these states. The fact that they refuse to listen to the people who were actually caring for the elderly. When these people, these caregivers, said, this is a bad move. These people are in a delicate condition. You can't put these people in here. We can't test these people effectively. They weren't equipped to handle people with COVID-19 and tried to tell them we shouldn't be doing this. But as you just heard, some of them even feared losing their license if they objected too highly, too strongly. And that's a sign of an oppressive, tyrannical government. If you object and they threaten you, or you're afraid of objecting because they may actually terminate your licensing, what kind of a government is running in these states where businesses that care for our precious elderly are afraid to stand up to bad decisions by their government? Progressive government, that's what kind of government we have in these states. Who believe they're intellectually and morally superior and won't consider the word of real experts on any subject when it disagrees with their view. And as a result, 70,000 fatalities, 42% of the COVID-19 deaths. The Democrats want to point a finger at Donald Trump. They're trotting out that figure. 180,000 people died. 70,000 of those deaths were directly the result of progressive leadership in progressive states. Last night, a guy who knows a bit about medicine spoke at the convention. HUD Secretary Ben Carson.
Good evening. I'm Ben Carson. a retired neurosurgeon, and a public servant. Before I begin, I'd like to say that our hearts go out to the Blake family and the other families who've been impacted by the tragic events in Kenosha. As Jacob's mother has urged the country, let's use our hearts, our love, and our intelligence to work together to show the rest of the world how humans are supposed to treat each other. America is great when we behave greatly. In order to succeed and change, we must first come together in love of our fellow citizens. History reminds us that necessary change comes through hope and love, not senseless and destructive violence. Abraham Lincoln once said to an America divided that, quote, "Your purpose then, plainly stated, is that you will destroy the government unless you be allowed to construe and enforce the Constitution as you please on all points in dispute between you and us. You will rule or ruin in all events," unquote. These words of warning are relevant today. We have a choice. Do we want big government that controls our lives from cradle to grave? Or do we believe in the power and wisdom of the people and their ability to self-govern with help from a limited federal government? Our president, Donald J. Trump, believes in the people. He is one of us. He makes promises and he keeps them. He is transparent, and we certainly know what he's thinking. He does not submit to political correctness or to its enforcers, the media. He is real. Right now, we need real. We need courage. We can't cower in the corner and hope that no one calls us a name, believing that will keep us safe. That is not courage, and that will not lead us to a good and just place. We must remember all those who sacrificed everything in order to give us freedom, and we must be willing to do the same for those who come after us. President Trump does not dabble in identity politics. He wants everyone to succeed and believes in the adage, a rising tide lifts all boats. Many on the other side love to incite division by claiming that President Trump is a racist. They could not be more wrong. Years ago, Jesse Jackson gave Donald Trump an award for the economic opportunities he created for Black people. In Palm Beach, Florida, Donald Trump led the crusade to allow Blacks and Jews into private clubs and resorts. One of the first things he did as president was bring the Office of Historically Black Colleges and Universities into the White House so that it could get proper attention and financial support. Before the pandemic, African-American unemployment was at an all-time low. President Trump accomplished prison reform. He created incentives to encourage investors to become involved with economically deprived areas of America. He strongly supports school choice, fully recognizing that no matter what circumstances a person is born into, they can achieve success with a good education. It was true for me. When my mother forced me to read books about doctors, entrepreneurs, inventors, and scientists, I began to recognize that the person who has the most to do with what happens to you in life is you. My mother always told me, "Ben, you can do anything, but I will never allow you to become a victim." It was then that I stopped listening to the people who were trying to convince me that I was a victim and that others were responsible for my victimhood. What is racist is the fact that African Americans have the highest abortion rate. President Trump is the most pro-life president in the country's history. He will continue to fight for those who cannot yet speak. The vision of a shining city upon a hill came from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. America is that shiny city. We are the beacon of hope for the world. At this moment in time, President Donald Trump is the man with the courage, the vision, and the ability to keep it shining brightly.
Dr. Ben Carson from last night at the Republican National Convention. Still more to come after the break when the Daily Perspective continues. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast. Jumping into the final segment for this Friday, the 28th day of August. This is a story I've had in my stack for a couple of days, and I just haven't been getting around to it because of the convention. And so in this final segment, I want to deal with this and one other thing before we move along. And that story is that Hillary Clinton has had something to say, and I think it's really interesting what she has had to say, because quite frankly, she's wow. It amazes me that she can say some of the things she does with a complete lack of awareness, and so. She has said this, that if mail-in voting causes the November election to drag out, Democrats should be prepared for a legal battle. She spoke with former aide Jennifer Palmieri about the upcoming election and how she would advise former Vice President Joe Biden to proceed, especially in the event that the fight transitioned from the ballot box to the courts. She says, I think that Republicans have a couple of scenarios that they're looking toward. One is messing up absentee balloting. They believe that helps them so that they can get maybe a narrow advantage in the Electoral College on Election Day. So we've got to have a massive legal operation, and I know the Biden campaign is working on that. Now think about this. President Trump has not been talking about messing up absentee balloting. What she is doing is conflating absentee balloting with what the Democrat Party is actually proposing, which is mail-in voting. They are, regardless of what their propaganda and propagandists may say, they are two entirely separate things. Absentee ballots, and I know this personally because just yesterday I printed off the absentee ballot request forms for my wife and myself because it looks like we're going to be out of town on Election Day. We're going to be out of the state. So we're going to go ahead and get our ballots taken care of early because we won't be in our home state to be able to cast our ballots on Election Day. So I know this is happening and I know how it works. You request an absentee ballot. You are proactive. You make that determination. You request the ballot and you take the action for the vote. Mail-in voting? The state pushes the ballot to you, whether you want it or not. Even if you are planning on voting in person, the state pushes the ballot to you. And because it sits in your mailbox and possibly goes to an address you used to live at and not your current address, and because you may receive ballots for other people who used to live where you live, and because if you use it, the Postal Service could misplace it. Have you ever received your neighbor's mail? Have your neighbors ever received your mail? Has a bill payment ever been lost in the mail? Has a bill ever been lost in the mail? Have you ever had to track down something sent by the U.S. through the U.S. Postal Service that was supposed to be delivered to you, was marked delivered, and you never received? These things are completely different than the system of absentee ballots. Completely different. And she is mixing them up and saying that the president is messing with absentee balloting when he's not. He's advocating absentee balloting and has many, many times. Because he absentee ballots, he's a resident of Florida. And he requests ballots for his home state and votes from Washington, D.C. via absentee ballot. Clinton said that she believes a close race, if it goes to a court, would break in Biden's favor if he was just able to hold out long enough. Do the words hanging chads mean anything to you? That's what they hoped for then. They hoped that they could challenge in court and that Al Gore would be president. She said, Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances because I think this is going to drag out. And eventually, I do believe he will win if we don't give an inch and if we're as focused and relentless as the other side is. She's previously suggested that President Trump would refuse to leave office if he lost in November. She told the 19th President Represents Summit, I don't want to scare people, but I want you to be prepared. I have every reason to believe that Trump is not going to, you know, go silently into the night if he loses. He's going to try to confuse us. He's going to try to bring all kinds of lawsuits. He's got his crony Attorney General William Barr ready to do whatever is necessary. Hillary Clinton is known for a handful of things, but one of those things is being a prolific liar, a deceiver, a misdirector. And I think in this, in her pride, in her arrogance, she's given us a little bit of a glimpse into the Democrat plan. Because we know that the Democrats project. It's their method of operation. They project their sin onto their opponents. They know they can't win. So they're setting up an election disaster with mail-in voting. So they can challenge the outcome when Trump wins. The Biden campaign has hired 600 attorneys. 600 attorneys. Or they are in the process of hiring 600 attorneys. Why would you need 600 attorneys unless you are planning a massive legal challenge at the end of the campaign? Oh, it's to take care of little things, odds and ends. No. Every campaign has staff attorneys. The Democrat Party has attorneys. They're hiring 600 more. Be aware. The Democrats are trying to create chaos in this election. And the Democrats hope that chaos will give them the time they need to manipulate the outcome so that Joe Biden comes out the winner. One other thing, Kenosha, Wisconsin. We still don't know, we still don't feel like we have enough to take a hard and fast stance about the shooting there. 7 shots in the back is excessive. It seems that way. Was it justified to fire any shots at all? Police were responding to a call from a woman who said her boyfriend was on the premises, wasn't supposed to be there. It's a little unclear on this point. Presumably the boyfriend was Blake. When the police tried to arrest him, he wasn't cooperative. They tried to use their tasers. The tasers were ineffective. Against police orders to stop, he approached his car, attempted to get behind the wheel, and that is when Officer Rustin Chesky fired 7 times. He also had a knife. It's unclear whether or not the officers knew he had a knife at the time, but he had a knife. Photos, still frames from video, show something in his hand. It's fairly clear, and he's also said, being in the hospital, he has said, yes, he had a knife. Now, beyond all of this, we now know that Blake was issued a warrant on July 7th for felony third-degree sexual assault, disorderly conduct, and criminal trespass, all relating to domestic abuse. There was a warrant out for his arrest. And so the police showed up. In response to a call, apparently there is also a restraining order. He's not supposed to be near these people. The police respond to a call in reference to the violation of a restraining order. It turns out the guy they show up to get there, and they're told on the radio on their way, by the way, he has a warrant out for his arrest. So they know they're going to pick up someone who has a warrant, who has a record of violence. And then he has a knife. He refuses to cooperate. And in a situation, in the door of a motor vehicle with a known violent felon who refuses to cooperate with the cops, a police officer fires and does not kill. And once again, Black Lives Matter and the Black community rise up to defend a criminal. And that's what we know about this case. And another thing I know is I'm done for the day and for the week. Have a good weekend. We'll see you back here Monday. God bless. Bye-bye.
Knock off now and take the next 2 days off. How's that?